Let's push into another week of our 4.5 year verse-by-verse journey through all of God's inspired word by opening the book of Isaiah to chapter number 4, verse number 2, where we'll begin in just one moment. Isaiah was called to be God's minister, God's prophet, during the year that King Uzziah died. That's 738 BC. This is a crisis point in Middle Eastern history. Very soon, the resurgent Assyrian Empire is going to sweep southward and take a lot of people into exile, including the northern kingdom of Israel. It will be totally ended. Samaria will be destroyed, and that whole kingdom will be erased from history. Southern Judah is going to also suffer a little bit underneath this Assyrian invasion, but they will not disappear from the pages of history just yet. They are given more time. And Isaiah is the prophet ministering to Judah during this period, letting them know what is going to transpire. And that includes some immediate judgments, but also warnings about the ultimate judgment of God, also known as the Day of the Lord, which is related to the second coming of Jesus. I think we can pin it down to the 3.5 years described in the book of Revelation right before the second coming. In connection with the Day of the Lord, Isaiah gives little hints, little cameos, little vignettes of what is in store after the Day of the Lord, when there will be peace on earth, when there will be a great kingdom that God is ruling over, what in New Testament terms we refer to as the millennial kingdom, which just ushers in the eternal kingdom. In Isaiah chapter 4, verse 2, we have one of those descriptions of the millennial period. It's set in this introductory portion of the book of Isaiah, which seems to have kind of a collection of things that Isaiah said over the years of his ministry. So let's look at Isaiah chapter 4, verse 2. In that day, meaning in the day once the judgment is all finished and God is reigning, in that day, the branch of he who is shall be beautiful and glorious, and the fruit of the land shall be the pride and honor of the survivors of Israel. So that's all good stuff. The survivors here would be the righteous remnant. In the terms of the millennial kingdom, we're talking about all the righteous dead and transformed living that have been caught up together to meet the Lord in the air, and thus they will always be with the Lord. And they will be brought to the Middle East of the new heaven and new earth, and there they will rule and reign with Jesus. The branch of the Lord here, as I told you when we were closing up last Friday, can be a reference to Jesus himself. In Isaiah chapter 11, coming up later in the book, the word netzer is used about this branch that's going to pop up from the cutoff root of Jesse's family, of the Davidic kingdom. And that's a clear reference to Jesus, and it also seems to be the source word for the name of the city of Nazareth from which Jesus comes. So effectively, Jesus is a branch that grows up at Branch Town in Galilee. Now, the word here, though, is not the word netzer. It's another word that's got the idea of something popping up. And it may also be a reference to the righteous remnant, because they're going to pop up as well. They're going to be raised from the dead, and they're going to be raised as the transformed and living into the sky to be brought into this eternal kingdom. So we've got a lot of things kind of jam-packed into this passage here, little hints and promises. Verse 3, he who is left in Zion and remains in Jerusalem will be called holy. Everyone who has been recorded for life in Jerusalem, when the Lord shall have washed away the filth of the daughters of Zion and cleansed the bloodstains of Jerusalem from its midst by a spirit of judgment and by a spirit of burning. So here we've got the description of what will happen over time from Isaiah's period forward. Through a series of judgments, through a series of prophetic events, Jesus is going to come on the scene. He's going to die for our sins. He's going to raise for our justification. And then eventually the day of the Lord comes along and the judgment comes upon those that take the mark, and the righteous remnant is brought together out of death and transformed into their eternal bodies, and they were brought to Jerusalem in the new heaven and new earth to reign with Jesus. So all of that is kind of talked about here in this passage. And so judgment is gone out of the picture by this time. Verse number 5. And this is the part I really, really love about this section. Then he who is will create over the whole site of Mount Zion. And that's Mount Zion is a reference to the Temple Mount during this period of Isaiah. And by extension, to the entirety of Jerusalem. So he who is in the millennial period is going to create over the whole site of Mount Zion and over her assemblies. That's the people that are gathered there, the righteous remnant that have been resurrected, transformed, caught up together and meet the Lord in the air, and brought to Jerusalem. He's going to create over Mount Zion and over her assemblies a cloud by day and smoke and shining of a flaming fire by night. For over all the glory there will be a canopy. This is a description, of course, of the Shekinah glory of God from the time of Moses, where God appeared to Israel in this, what appears to be a column of fire by night, a glowing cloud by day, that leads Israel through the wilderness and provides protection for them. Later in a prophetic book, it is described as being representative of God's Holy Spirit, God's presence, his visible, tangible presence with them. And I believe that that glory cloud in the Old Testament is exactly as it's described here for the millennial period. It's not just simply a glory cloud like a pillar, it also expands up at the top, over the top of the encampment, like a great big umbrella, which helps us understand other passages that describes how the Israelis were not hurt by the heat of the day, nor in the middle of the desert were they harmed by the cold of the night. And that's exactly what would happen if you had this great big glory cloud canopy over the encampment. It would moderate the temperature both day and night, and it also provided a nightlight for the Israelis, so they were never in the dark. That glory cloud of God's presence is going to be back in the millennial period, according to this passage. I tend to be a literalist when the millennial passages describe what will happen when Jesus returns at his second coming, that he will rule and reign from Jerusalem, and that there will be a literal river of the water of life coming out of the Temple Mount and going both east and west and bringing the tree of life on both sides. I believe all of that is going to literally happen in the millennial kingdom. And so I also believe the glory cloud of God will be there as well. Verse number 6, there will be a booth for a shade by the day from the heat, and for a refuge and a shelter from the storm and rain. So the booth here having a reference, I think, to the glory cloud being like this canopy over the top of the eternal kingdom of Jesus Christ. Looking forward to it. Very excited to be able to see that in person one of these days. At this point, Isaiah puts into his document, into his final printed form of the book of Isaiah, a little song that God is singing. Chapter 5, "Let me sing for my beloved my love song concerning his vineyard. My beloved had a vineyard on a very fertile hill. He dug it and cleared it of stones and planted it with choice vines. He built a watchtower in the midst of it and hewed out a wine vat in it, and he looked for it to yield grapes, but it yielded wild grapes." Now, the poetic description here is of what God did with Israel. We see other places where God describes Israel as a fruitful vine. God went to Egypt and he brought the vine of Israel out of that wilderness and across the wilderness experience to the promised land, and he planted them in his chosen vineyard, the promised land, the land of Israel. And he did everything needed to prepare the land for them. He even built a watchtower for this vineyard, which I believe is a reference to the city of Jerusalem, and maybe even specifically the Temple Mount itself. But here's where the problem happens. When he expected his vineyard to produce great grapes, a wonderful vintage, it instead reverted to its wild form, its sinful form, and produced wild grapes of wrath. Verse 3, "And now, O inhabitants of Jerusalem and men of Judah, judge between me and my vineyard." So give me your legal decision. What should happen to my vineyard when it's gone wild again? It's gone back to its old way of living. "What more is there to do for my vineyard that I have not done for it? When I looked for it to yield grapes, why did it yield wild grapes? And now I will tell you what I will do to my vineyard. I will remove its hedge," that is its protective wall. "It shall be devoured. I will break down its wall and it shall be trampled down. I will make it a waste, and it shall not be pruned or hoed, and briars and thorns shall grow up. I will also command the clouds that they rain no more upon it." This is a description of what will eventually happen to the city of Jerusalem and to the Temple Mount. Not during the time of Isaiah, but rather many, many generations later, a couple hundred years later, when God will allow the Babylonians to come in and break the place apart and take the people into exile. So Isaiah is not just simply talking about his days, he's talking about future days. Verse 7, "For the vineyard of he who is over the armies, the Lord of hosts, is the house of Israel, and the men of Judah are his pleasant planting. He looked for justice, but behold, bloodshed." So this is where you see the explanation of the metaphor or the parable. The good vintage should have been justice, doing things God's way. But instead, they are engaging in injustice, bloodshed. Righteousness, and behold, an outcry. So God was expecting a harvest of holiness and righteousness, and instead, he's getting a bunch of noise. He's getting a bunch of sinful outcry. And that's why judgment has to come. Verse 8, "Woe to those who join house to house," meaning they just keep expanding their property to be richer and richer, who add field to field, again, same description, only this time in reference to agriculture, until there is no more room and you are made to dwell alone in the midst of the land. So they get so full of themselves that there's no more room for God. He who is over the hosts, over the armies, has sworn in my hearing, surely many houses shall be desolate, large and beautiful houses without inhabitant. So he's just described it how the people in their sinfulness keep building more and more properties for themselves. And God says, all that's going to go desolate. It's going to be emptied of the population. And then remember, the other thing was fields to fields. Verse 10 predicts what's going to happen on that. For 10 acres of vineyard, and that's, I'm afraid that's a somewhat arbitrary comparison for our Western way of thinking of property. The literal wording is 10 yoke, meaning the property that 10 yoke of oxen could plow, prepping for the seeding of wheat or barley or some other grain in a single day of work. Now, that's going to be, I think, probably more than 10 acres. But the point is here, 10 acres of vineyard shall yield but one bath. So whatever this acreage is, it's all planted in grapevines, because that's the image we've already been using. And at the end of it, you should get a huge amount of produce from that, a lot of wine. But instead, it only yields one bath, which is roughly about a little less than 10 gallons. So that's not a good return on all that work investment, is it? And a homer of seed shall yield but an ephah. So a homer of seed is, I can't remember exactly what it is. It's several bushels worth, but it's going to be a lot less than what you planted. So you used up more seed kernels than what you're going to get back. It's actually about 1/10 of what was put into the ground. This is all God warning them. Eventually, Judah is going to be overrun and taken out of the land because they're not producing righteousness. Verse 11, woe to those who rise early in the morning that they may run after strong drink. So they're not getting up to go to work. They're getting up to partay. Who tarry late into the evening as wine inflames them. So they're also staying up late because they want to partay some more. That's the sort of attitude that is going to take over in the southern kingdom and bring the judgment of God upon them. They have lyre and harp, tambourine and flute and wine at their feasts, but they do not regard the deeds of he who is or see the work of his hands. So they are all about the musical entertainment and getting drunk, and it's a description, I'm afraid, of our modern Western society as well. And it brings judgment. And God's day of the Lord will be coming eventually because of that sort of disregard for the righteousness of God. Now back to the prediction of Isaiah regarding Judah. Therefore my people go into exile for lack of knowledge. So northern Israel is going to be going into Assyrian exile less than 15 years after Isaiah started his ministry. Northern Israel will be following very shortly, relatively speaking, in historical terms, thereafter into their Babylonian exile. And the reason it's happening is because they don't have the knowledge of the Lord. Do you remember that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom? It's the beginning of knowledge. If you don't have that, you're going to come under judgment. Their honored men go hungry. That's very common when a land is being overrun by an invading army. Their multitude is parched with thirst. Therefore, Sheol has enlarged its appetite and opened its mouth beyond measure. So the place of the dead is ready to receive all these dying people. And the nobility of Jerusalem and her multitude will go down. Her revelers, the partiers, and he who exults in her, they're all going down. Man is humbled and each one is brought low, and the eyes of the haughty are brought low. So they're full of themselves, and that's why judgment comes. He who is over the armies is exalted in justice, and the Holy One shows himself holy in righteousness. So while everybody else is going down, God is going up. He is showing that he is the Holy One, the righteous one, and doing the right thing. Then shall the lambs graze as in their pasture, and nomads shall eat among the ruins of the rich. So once a city is overrun and destroyed and there's no more populace to keep it up, it just kind of turns into pasture land. Woe to those who draw iniquity with cords of falsehood, who draw sin as with cart ropes. Kind of a poetic way of describing these guys are just moving forward, dragging their sins with them. Who say, let us be quick. Let him speed his work that we may see it. Let the counsel of the Holy One of Israel draw near. Let it come that we may know it. Now that is a very strange thing to find in the middle of this. Basically, challenging God. If you're going to do something, do it. So they've been warned repeatedly about the impending judgment. And the way that they're kind of responding to it here is, fine, just get it over with if that's what's going to happen. Meaning they don't really believe it's coming. Verse number 20. Woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who put darkness for light and light for darkness, who put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. So those that flip things on their heads and talk about how getting drunk and taking advantage of people, that's a good thing because you get what you want. Whereas depriving yourself, humbling yourself, that's a bad thing because you don't get what you want. They're flipping things on their heads as comparison to what God wants. We're supposed to humble ourselves under God's mighty hand and let him lift us up in due time. And we're supposed to be holy and righteous like him instead of being self-centered and demanding. Verse 21, along those lines, woe to those who are wise in their own eyes and shrewd in their own sight. Woe to those who are heroes at drinking wine and valiant men in mixing strong drink. Wow, that's definitely a condemnation of this partying attitude. Who acquit the guilty for a bribe and deprive the innocent of his right. So again, going opposite of what God would want. Therefore, as the tongue of fire devours the stubble, after harvest time, there's always stubble out there that gets burned up. And as dry grass sinks down into the flame, so their root will be as rottenness, and their blossom goes down to like dust, goes up like dust. For they have rejected the law of he who is over the armies and have despised the word of the Holy One of Israel. So judgment is coming on them because they don't do things God's way. Therefore, the anger of he who is was kindled against his people. He stretched out his hand against them and struck them. The mountains quaked. Their corpses were as refuse in the midst of the streets. For all this, his anger has not turned away, and his hand is stretched out still. Now, when Isaiah is writing these things down, he's seen the future. He's seen the judgment already, and he's describing it in a past tense sense. But it's still future in the time that he's writing to, the time that he's speaking to. He will raise a signal for nations far off, and whistle for them from the ends of the earth, and behold, quickly, speedily they come. So when the day of the Lord does show up, first, the day of the Lord for Israel, the day of the Lord for Judah, and all of that's going to be happening historically that we'll be watching. But ultimately, the day of the Lord, right before Jesus comes back, it involves letting foreign armies come in and do great damage. So God is pictured as signaling for them to come on in. Verse 27, describing those groups. None is weary, none stumbles, none slumbers or sleeps. Not a waistband is loose, not a sandal strap broken. So they're prepped to fight. Their arrows are sharp, all their bows bent. Their horses' hoof seem like flint, and their wheels like the whirlwind. So they are well equipped. And that's exactly what the Assyrian army looked like for northern Israel, and exactly what the Babylonian army looked like for southern Judah. Verse 29, their roaring is like a lion. Like young lions, they roar, they growl, and seize their prey. They carry it off, and none can rescue. We've seen this before, that judgment is often described in the sense of a predatory animal attacking and killing and chewing up and dragging off and all of that. So that is exactly how the Assyrians and the Babylonians will do to these Israeli countries when God's judgment falls. And ultimately, it will be what happens the period of the millennium, or not the millennium, but the day of the Lord, when you've got the beast leader terrorizing the world. Verse 30, they will growl over it on the day like the growling of the sea. And if one looks to the land, behold darkness and distress, and the land is darkened by its clouds. So all of this is described in terms of darkness overspreading the land as God's judgment comes upon them. Tomorrow, we're going to go back to some of the historical passages and set the stage for a few more of Isaiah's prophecies. I hope you'll join me for that, and maybe bring somebody else along with you.